Recently, someone came to me and said, I wish you would speak sometime on the question of necessary evils. I said, are there any? And the party replied, I don't believe so, but I hear so much about them. I wonder what you would think about the question. I said, I might use those words as a title to a sermon, but if I could put a question mark behind them. And so here we are. Necessary evils. It might cover a great many more things. On inquiring what had been heard as necessary evils, I was told war and prostitution are so often called necessary evils. I don't think you can deal with any phase of the matter without taking up the whole question of evil as we are forced to face it from time to time. Let's sketch the larger picture, and perhaps we can make a contribution to this immediate question. The evil that results from man's ignorance and perverted will, we usually feel we understand and can account for it. Though often the cry goes up, why does God allow it? And as we have seen, some say that evil resulting from man's ignorance and perverted will is necessary, which I submit is too often a rationalization of desire or apathy. But when disease and disaster and premature death overtake us, and seemingly useless suffering has to be endured, the question is wrung from our hearts, why? Why should this be? Many answers have been forthcoming to that, and I'd like to indicate the five categories in which I would place them. First, there are those who say these things are but features of a universe that is indifferent to the values of mankind. Keep smiling. You will forget. The next throw of the dice may be better. That, I think, leaves us depressed. And it robs life of all meaning. Yet others would say, fate rules. What is to be, will be. Adjust yourself to it and keep on. What's the use of repining? Take what comes. I think that's worse. The surrender to fate. It paralyzes us. Then we hear that there is a good God at the heart of things, but he's opposed by a devil. Someday the evil forces will be unseated and defeated. Meantime, God allows these things. This too, to some of us, is very unsatisfactory, philosophically and religiously and scientifically. Yet again, we are told that evil has no real existence. It lives only in the faulty thinking of man. Only the good is real. That helps some people, and it gets rid of some of their imaginary ills. But most people feel that this is inadequate as an answer. Then once again we are told all is part of the great plan of God. All suffering, all evil, all pain, all loss. Be resigned to his will. That's the best statement, I think, as far as I'm concerned. It's heroic in its resignation. that I feel that it does injustice to God and to man. The point of view that appeals to me, and I submit to you, is a modification of number 5, a radical modification, I grant you, but it's related there. And I would put it this way, that many of the things we call evil are byproducts, not sought for or desired by God, but incidental to his greater purposes. Some years ago, when my boy was about 7 and we were in New Hampshire spending the summer at the lake, he put me on the spot with this very issue. We were in the garage and making a boat. He was slapping his bare knees to kill the mosquitoes. Presently, he looked up into my face and said very desperately, "Dad, I've heard you say that God made everything. Why in the world did he make mosquitoes? I can't see any earthly use for them." Accepting the child's negative appraisal of the mosquitoes and ignoring the possibility they might play some unknown part in the economy of nature, what could be said to help a child? Well, I attempted a pictorial reply. I said, "Son, what are we doing here?" "Well, we're making a boat, I hope." "Well, who made all these chips and filings?" "Why, we made them, of course." I said, "We don't want them." He said, "How can you make a boat without making chips and filings?" I said, "That's just it. The part of our job is to clean up this place when we get through. Making the boat is the main thing, and cleaning up is the secondary thing. And we better do it." I said then, I think, son, that in the creation of this beautiful and wonderful world and all the wonders of human life, it's likely that God made many things in a secondary way that he wasn't wanting as he wants some other things. He too has byproducts in the process. And again, one of our jobs is to help him clean up his workshop. That was an improvised explanation on the spot, but it still lingers in my mind. A crude and limited illustration, but somehow I feel yet that it points in the direction of a profound truth. That man is organically related to the universe. The same divine creative processes that created the universe produced us in the one process. That man's physical life is the outcome of a long, long development of a cell, which was brought into being by creative forces, which incidentally, in the process, brought into being other forms of life, some less desirable and some undesirable. Thus, the very circumstances, the kind of world necessary for man's life and progress, at times gave rise to disease and pain and suffering not desired by the Creator. They're features of a world necessary for our being. Byproducts. For instance, we couldn't live without the help of some of the microscopic forms of life in this world. Some of them help to produce our food. Some of them assist in our bodily functions. But the same forces that produces these friends produces others which are undesirable byproducts. We find ourselves, therefore, as grown-up sons and daughters of God, sharing the Father's workshop, where he's still working, he hasn't stopped. And on us falls the duty and the necessity, helping to clean up the workshop. How true the psalmist's words regarding man. Thou hast made him but little lower than God. Already he has learned to clean up diseases that once were scourges. Someday things like cancer and polio, they'll go. They're on their way out. How vital this makes all life, and how significant the words, co-workers with God. What a contribution it makes to freeing us from the fears, errors, and problems that have hung so heavily on the hearts of other generations. Disaster in the form of floods and earthquakes is not to be traced to visitations of God's wrath, nor are they factors of a universe that is indifferent to man. They are but the incidental features of a universe which, by the same laws, produced man and made all his wonderful capacities possible. Can't have the one without the other. Accidents are not to be interpreted as the workings of his inscrutable will, nor to malign forces, but to the working of those very same laws by which we are brought into being, without which we couldn't exist. Disease and premature death are not intrusions of his hand of punishment, nor even expressions of his will for us. Under those circumstances, I cannot say the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away, but that the outworking of the same laws which on the whole make for health and progress. Now, against this larger background, what are the two evils that were mentioned? War, an evil but necessary to control population, as some say, to blend the races, to give economic stimulus, to keep the heroic alive in the soul of man, and so forth. No, all these things can be done in a much more intelligent manner, if we want to choose to do so. War is an evil, period. It's pretty nearly the sum total of all evils. Name them all. When you have war, you just about have them. It's the fruition of weak, selfish, lazy choices which make war not necessary but inevitable. And even inevitable has to be modified. Looking at that mountain, it is not inevitable that the boulder up there rolled down on a certain house. In the first place, the house need not have been put in the line of that boulder. And the threatening boulder might have been anchored, if we're interested. But once it's rolling, it cannot be stopped. And so with war. It's the result of things we have done and of things we carelessly or deliberately left undone or tried to do too late. It's not a necessity. It's not inevitable, fundamentally. But it becomes inevitable once we start a series of processes. Prostitution and evil, but necessary to our social life, we're told. Basic to that thought is the idea that some people are expendable in the social process. which idea is absolutely intolerable to the Christian conscience. Its presence arises from such factors as failure to be able to handle economic needs, lack of ideas and ideals to direct the creative urge, and the egocentric urge for satisfaction without responsibility and without depth. Necessary? The necessity is to correct these things. The action or the lack of action arising out of undeveloped personality. The failure to achieve maturity in social living. To accept the necessity of prostitution, instead of facing the necessity of correcting its causes, is simply rationalizing oneself into an area that's more comfortable to think about and getting rid of the problem. Looking at the larger picture again, I would say that the heart of God is well reflected in the picture of Jesus at the tomb of Lazarus, where, confronted with disease and death and desolation, we read, Jesus wept. If we know anything of God through Christ, and who can doubt that? We know that there is a sob at the heart of the universe over the awful waste of life going on and the pain and grief and suffering of the world. And there is a love that will not let us go until all the suffering of creation is swallowed up in a realization of God's great objective, when as heirs of God we shall inherit the fullness of life. And yet this would be an unsatisfactory presentation of God, something less than Christianity, if we left him weeping over the unfortunate byproducts of the creative process. Christianity has a further message. It's at the very heart. And I would remind you of that incident in 1798 in England, when they developed a new use of coal. The production of gas was desired. And having got the gas, they got the coke, and they could use them both. And there was a big market for them. But the more gas and coke they produced, the more a problem was growing on their hands. A black, sticky mess. A residue they didn't know what in the world to do with. They dug holes and buried it. They put it on barges and they took it out to sea and unloaded it. But it still grew. It was a nightmare and an expense, this byproduct. Then the scientists began to take notice of it, and things began to happen. And they're still happening. Every year finds more and more discoveries regarding coal tar. Hundreds of chemicals have been derived from it, with far-reaching effects on all life. It's become the basis of numerous industries and a fundamental factor in many others, and has enriched all life. From it we derive things which we cannot very well do without. Ammonia, naphtha, benzol, carbolic, saccharin, dyes, perfume, Lysol, celluloid, anesthetics. Now, I might go on into the dozens, things you know. They didn't know at that time. This seemingly impossible byproduct yielded some of the greatest values for modern living. Here is a parable of the great possibilities for human life. In such byproducts of creation as pain and loss and disease and suffering, whether arising from ignorance, malice, or accident. All this dark, unpromising material can be made to yield tremendous contributions to life. They can be redeemed, to use the historic word. One of the greatest lessons Christianity would teach men is how to distill from these things beauty and sweetness and nobility of character. Very unpromising material. But I tell you that the outcome of coal tar plus human ingenuity is as nothing compared to the outcome of adversity plus human patience, faith, and love, and divine strength. We'd better learn that art more and more. But again, such results do not come automatically or inevitably. You can distill other things from adversity and from the negative side of life, if you will. And you will if you're not careful. For instance, toluene, which we get from coal tar. From that, in turn, we get color and perfume and saccharin, anesthetics, and also TNT. It's all according to what you want, and how you handle it. So from adversity and suffering and misunderstanding and malice and persecution and loss, we can extract strength and nobility of character. Or we can experience bitterness and resentment that will warp our minds and poison our souls. It's up to us. So I point you not to a God who has planned the woes of mankind, nor to a God who is thwarted by a devil, but to a Father, the scope of whose mighty purposes necessitated some risks. To a Father, however, who is increasingly triumphant and moves steadfastly toward his objective and must win. A Father whose grace and strength and comradeship are so mighty and comprehensive that he can teach us and help us to distill from life's black byproducts the very colors of heaven, the strength and sweetness of sympathy and understanding, and the fragrance of the Father's house. George Matheson knew it when he said, "O cross that liftest up my head, I dare not ask to fly from thee. I lay in dust life's glory dead, and from the ground there blossoms red life that shall endless be."